to take an intro.
Well, why don't you get your favorite hanging on there? How about this one? You like this one?
Oh, yeah, that one's pretty.
That's pretty right there. Now, come here, let me show you something. I like the Blue Balls.
Nueve. Blue Balls NYCFC. Season 9.
I like the Blue Balls. The Blue Balls.
Nueve.
Blue Balls.
Season 9. Nueve.
Like! What? What? What?
I said I am, but I said it very late.
Oh, good. All right, well, great. Like myself in fourth grade, spending all of my lunch money on as many fruit roll-ups as I could in order to make a fist-size wad or two to eat. Ladies and gentlemen, you've got Blue Balls. My name is Jake Beckard, and I am your intrepid cohorse, and I am joined this week, as every week, by my intrepid cohorse, Mr. Trey Fillmore. Trey, how are you this week, Cat Dad?
Oh, things are great. Everything is good. Nothing is triggering my anxiety at all. Things are fantastic. How about you?
That's nice. That sounds lovely. Are you sending that out to any concerned listeners from last week?
No, I mean, no. Generally, I'm okay. It's just the complications when, after last podcast, my wife was like, surprise, we're fostering a kitten. And I was like, oh, yeah, that thing I said I didn't want to do. His name is Guillermo. He is only almost 8 weeks now, but he's really undersized. So he's a tiny little baby, but he's also the cutest thing I've ever seen in my life. But also he's at the age where he now is like, oh, big human man, we are going to fuck about, and wants to play all the time. And
yep, he's a rough and tumble creature.
I have him out of the office, locked out, and currently cannot find him on my pet can.
Oh, good.
So, who knows where he is? But he's not in here.
Yeah, he's getting into some kind of a trouble.
At least he's not getting into trouble here.
I'm always, you know, when I had a cat, and she used to, a closed door, like, you'd close that door, and then it would all of a sudden be as if the, like, Demigorgon was fucking slamming against that door. Like, it, like, truly, their size or their force multiplies by 20 when they want to get in somewhere. And all of a sudden, Serena used to send me photos of the cat, like, jabbing a hand, claws extended, under the bathroom door while she was taking a shit. Like, truly, like, horror movie level. They can't, sometimes, there's no separating them. You know what else it's like? It's like that movie Solaris. That's for our cinemaphiles. It's like when they close the door on the clones in Solaris, and then they rip the doors off the hinges. That's cat parenting. But this is great, Trey. I don't know why we didn't think about this last week, or, you know, 2 weeks ago, I guess, because you didn't have the cat. But we should be broadcasting. We should make half the podcast about Guillermo. You're like that much more likely to find a foster.
Oh, absolutely. If you guys need a little kitty in the next week or two, he will be available. And he is an angel. I do want to point out, he's an angel. He's never pooped anywhere that he can't. He is the most adorable thing ever. He just has like kitten moments. He just loves crawl spaces where he can't find you, where you can't find him, preferably where there's electrical cables that he can chew on.
And, you know, kitten season is the talking point that I used when we fostered, but kitten season is a limited time, and it is coming to an end in the fall. Soon there will not be a lot of kittens available because this is the season that you get the surplus.
So oh, he's going to get snapped up immediately, so.
I'm saying, yeah, get in there. We'd rather give them to a fan. We'd rather give, not them, him, that one cat that you have. And that's pretty much what we have in terms of bright spots, isn't it, Trey? There's, you know, the sun is out, the guns are out, and they're pressed firmly against our temples. It has not been an amazing week to take off for NYCFC. But folks, it's not our job to have opinions, or well, it is our job to have opinions about the news, but it's not our job to get beaten by the news. It's our job to report the news, and the news is not great. I'm going to leave the order of events up to you, Trey. There's so much to talk about in the talking points territory, but we also have three matches we have not broken down. Would you rather get into this sequence of matches, or would you rather jump straight into talking about the departures, injuries, and crises facing the New York City Football Club?
I think we can do what we usually do when there's a a handful of games that we haven't talked about. It's like kind of point out overall themes and maybe individual performances for better or for worse. And then we can hit on kind of the news after that. But, you know, I think, you know, we didn't record last week. I was kind of, there was a moment where I was desperate to have my thoughts, and obviously with the whole Chanel thing that was going on. But then at the same time, like, I knew it would be okay to wait because, you know, every time we've won a game this year, we've always jumped on, like, ooh, good things to build on. This team can actually win like this. Let's keep it going. And they always failed. And it just happened again, you know? After the Cincinnati game, Oliver Strand wrote a good little piece for Hudson River Blue about, like, the two teams that this team can be. And one of it is what we saw in Cincinnati. Listless, just seem to not know what they're doing and have never been on a pitch together before. And especially, most importantly, like the inability to fight back or to have any kind of emotional stake in the game. And then the other side, which is where the team's running on all cylinders, they can overwhelm a team. You see that young talent really shine through. And we haven't obviously seen much more of the first than the latter. I wouldn't even say we've seen a lot of the team looking desperately awful necessarily, given that this team hasn't technically lost a lot of games this year. It's more that the most recent game we had, Vancouver, I think showed the third path that this team has taken a majority of the year, which is somewhere between the two, which is stupid mistakes that interrupt any of the good things you're trying to do and create situations that this team is unable to come back from, even if they're playing well. And I think we got the whole gamut of NYCFC in the three games that we saw. Would you agree?
I would definitely agree. Enough so that I feel like, right, like like you said, it symbolized an inability to retain the version of NYCFC that we've been sitting around dreaming about for this entire season, right? Like, all of these lined up. I feel like one of the more depressing things is you can see which one is the true NYCFC, which to me is, like, it's not... When your ability to overwhelm a match is that inconsistent, it's not actually an ability that you have. It's a question that then it becomes a chemical question. It becomes like a special reaction that only ever happens sometimes. If it's not repeatable, it's not real. But we've certainly been able to repeat an ineffectiveness in front of goal.
Yeah, is that the end of the sentence, or did you get cut off?
Oh no, that was the end of sentence.
Oh, okay.
There are other bad things we've been able to repeat as well. But no, I just stopped talking. I implied.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about the Cincinnati match. Not that it went any better than we thought it would. That's the number one team in the East. They played like it. All these concerns are things about tight scheduling for them and playing 220-minute matches. It meant nothing. Like, they didn't have to expend a lot of energy to defeat us, and we kind of defeated ourselves. And then... the Montreal match obviously was bittersweet because there was the speculation and weirdness around Maxime Chanel, but also that might have been resolved before that. I'm losing the timetable. However, there was just like it was that feeling of, okay, we got our first win at home. Now we have to just keep this going, but knowing that this team is unable to do so, that they just haven't proven it. And and while it was a good performance and solid and, you know, good to see from this team, it didn't necessarily portend to any positives that looked like they could translate going forward, because it's just as easy as our schedule has been, the difficult teams we've had to play just find ways to beat us, whether it's like Cincinnati, just a whole performance using all the talents across every level of the field, or like Vancouver, where they played smart and that was kind of a more calculated chess match, and they were able to take advantage of their opportunity, and we were unable to.
It feels like we are often finding ourselves... I think one reason that it feels entirely dependent on the like style of the other team's play is that it feels like we're... like our side is being coached into a kind of like technical patience and probing, right? Like it's that that is not, that is anti-aggression, but like it's not reactive either, right? It's a sort of it is an ethos of patience, and that patience is not paying off. And so I think, like, rather than it being a patience so that we can learn about the other team's game and then, like, counter it, it's a patience looking for, I don't know, some opportunity that is never coming, or some sort of, like, magical thing or click. And it is such a breeding ground for insecurity to me. And I feel like that is the, like, the attacking struggles against Cincinnati are so emblematic of that. And I'll be, you know, never mind. That's my feeling mostly about that match. But I wonder if there were any standout performances that you took from that and you said, okay, great. And then maybe let's weave this through the rest of the matches. As you're looking at, for instance, new talent added and, like, potentials for turnarounds and hoped and prayed for that possibility, was there anything that you saw in the Cincinnati game that was delivered on in any way in the victory over Montreal?
Absolutely. You know, I think one of the big questions that has been answered in my mind to a certain extent, and was when it all these events had started to unfold, was about the inclusion of all this new talent, the biggest transfer window in the history of MLS, and how well they may or may not pan out, and whether it was too little too late. And I think we got our answer. And the answer for me, from our transfer window and what we've seen in the last three games, the, you know, the real MLS is back part of this season, is that the talent that we got is very good, and the players seem to fit in very well, and they were all good moves. However, it's just obviously not enough to save a season. It's just, unfortunately, when you have players that weren't playing well together anyway, and you throw in a bunch of new players, there will always be an inconsistency of style, of conformity, I would say. There was no building to anything necessarily in these moments. There was just a lot of good individual performances. I think, like, most obviously is Andres Perea. When we mentioned him on the podcast at first, you and I both saw him at Orlando, and we both know, like, he's a dog. He's very different to what this team has brought in recently. He kind of fits that Cacho Acevedo role in a bit, but I think his motor, he's a much faster player. He's more skilled. He has great closing speed. And if anything in the Cincinnati game, that was, he at least, he fights minute to minute. You know, he fights whistle to whistle, I should say. And that, just knowing that that panned out is great. Like, a good short-term loan from the team to get a player like him inserted into this lineup, not even knowing that James Sands would pick up an injury, but it seemed to be extremely helpful. Burke Risa obviously has continued to show off the passing range we saw in his first appearances. He had the assist to Bakrar. That's exactly what we were talking about. We wanted to see from him. Maxi Morales, who was technically an addition, just making everything work better. I think the Montreal game was the biggest Maxi Morales game, right? Because off the ball, dictating the press, becoming the anchor point of any offensive movement was so important, because we saw when he left, I mean, he left pretty late in the Vancouver game, but even so, even when he was on the field at the end of that game, like, the team fell into the moments that we usually fall into without him, which was the prayer circle offense, which was, if all the moments this team allows itself to be tied or losing, which is a majority of the time, 80% of the time, quite literally, they don't know how to break down any, there's no creativity or risk taking to break down any kind of mid to low block. And that's what you were just mentioning, how this team is young and they're coached to be smart. And it's hard because you have to find the balance of not letting players make too many mistakes, get discouraged, but also allowing them to play freely. And I think the way that the coaching staff and the front office has approached this season, and I think Maxime Cheneau leaving is a big indication of it, is betting on, we can teach young players the foundational techniques and IQ that will carry them through to be fantastic players, because the talent's already there. But what's happening is just a staleness that is making players lose the only thing they have, which is the fun and the talent and the risk taking that they have. They've overcommitted and failed because they didn't have a plan B. And how often have we said that about this team? But to get back to my original point, Max Morales obviously like really helped this team when he was on the field, just being that that safety valve, but also that go between the midfield and the offense. And of course, our boy Julian Fernandez, who, you know, I saw him for 2 minutes. I said I was in love with him, and then he showed us at the end of the Montreal game, like, this dude's for real. A level of talent we have not seen on this team in a very long time. I know we fell in love with Talos Magno, and that potential is still there with Julian. But at least there's, like his ability to, like, just use step-overs to create space against a back so that he can whip a cross in. Like, that's the kind of creativity and risk-taking that we need, that, like, GP had, that's you know, is what this team is at its best. And it's just unfortunate. Like, you see good things, like the counterattack that led to Jason's goal in the Montreal game. And, like, that's good. I like to see that. But that's a counterattack where the team had space. And, like, they've obviously something they've practiced. It's like this team can be good. They just need to. What happened in every match is mistakes. And those mistakes costing us extremely dearly. And then an emotional non-response to anything that was going on. And
That's my thing, is that it's not as if like the game plan doesn't work sometimes or couldn't work sometimes. Certainly it can, but it seems so non-adaptive for like the be smart attitude, right? Like it to me looks a lot like listening for the like window of opportunity when like the game plan as prepared can be executed. But when that's not what's happening, which for anybody like worth their salt looking at 90 minutes on the field, you're going to say that's what's not going to be happening for 90% of the time, it looks like we have no ideas. And that's my question about like training this idea of like training the young guns into an intelligence that will like pay dividends for them and for us later on. Can you do that when you are so consistently unrewarded for, like, if game after game you're unrewarded for the thing that you're getting coached into? Or are you actually like kind of putting your, is it counterproductive in a way to be trying and failing to be that smooth operator team for so long?
I think it is. Unfortunately, like, if you try to build this team into being a defensive counterattacking team, you know, that's not the City Football Group way, and I don't think that is the best way to train young players. But at the same time, if your whole team is young, then you risk alienating anyone else, including Maxime Cheneau or including, you know, Keaton Parks, who just looks fucking miserable out there. It sucks to people that have been on this team to be dipped into that malaise. It's a really hard balance the team's trying to play, but they can't. You know, I think the Vancouver game is a great example of like everyone having a plan until they're punched in the face. Like I liked that. It was the most boring first half we've ever played. I would say not that we played. I would say that the game was very boring. I think both teams played extremely well. It's just that it was a very even matchup, and both coaches were trying to out-coach each other. They were trying to outmaneuver each other. Both teams played extremely wide. NYCFC did their hybrid kind of formation that plays the edges but pushes one. Pushes Brian Cruffray up, but on every free kick, on every first third possession, NYCFC had their wingers hugging the sidelines, and Vancouver did the same exact thing. And so both teams were trying to fucking play around each other, and it wasn't working. Then NYCFC get the break, they score, and immediately after, it's just you know, they make a stupid mistake, and they can't fucking emotionally and mentally stay aware 90 seconds after a goal to keep a stupid mistake from happening. And it sucks to put everyone in that position, but it's just what happened, and it sucks. And like Montreal's, like, it's hard to take so much from that because they have Hernan Lozada. He's also a guy caught between two ideas, and therefore his team does not commit one way or the other. He's kind of become a mayonnaise manager because he's thought of a developmental manager, and he, like, that's just a team we can match up against really well. If we want to build out slowly, they gave us space for that. If we want to play the counter, they gave us space for that. So we took it. Any other good performances I saw? You know, we can talk briefly about the Matt Freese thing. I'm actually interested in talking about that. We can talk.
I wanted to ask that question because, you know, in doing my background research, I see you on the Reddit, in the Reddit comments, jumping in to quietly, respectfully defend Barraza against the haters. What is your take on the, right, like, because I think a lot of people are excited about Freese and feel like his performances in these, that he's earned, on like, a more serious look, and you've been stalwart in your defense of Barraza. Not that anybody's coming for his head, but they are coming for his job, and ensuring that, like, yes, these are both talented keepers is, like, the word from Fillmore on the street. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, I think the calls for Barraza's head mid-season were ridiculous and an overreaction from the fan base, which has happened on many times. Just the data didn't suggest.
Yeah, imagine that. Sort of hard to believe.
The data just didn't suggest it. Even the eye test didn't necessarily suggest it. He was getting beat on defensive blunders from his team. He was getting beat by set pieces where his team didn't cover an open runner. And even so, his stats were still not abysmal enough to ask for any certain upheaval or to tell a young goalkeeper that they're doing a bad job. I don't think that was the case at all mid-season. I think it's unfortunate that we're in a position, though. I think it's one of the, as we mentioned last podcast, like, the knocks we have on Nick Cushing have necessarily, like, I don't think have almost anything to do with his tactics necessarily. It's all the extracurricular stuff we talk about, him building the team with the front office in a way that alienates your older players or relies too heavily on younger players and teaching them whatever. The whole Chanot situation, of course. But also, you look at this goalkeeping situation. Why has the... I don't understand. Like, having two young keepers fight it out is fine. But, like, either go to bat for them hard or decide that one of them is the number one. Because either way, you're going to kill the confidence of one or the other. Like, not explaining to the fans that clearly have no idea what they're thinking of when they're saying this. Like, Luis Barraza's in his first season as a starter, and he's 25. There is no way in hell he was ever going to be a top third keeper. No keeper worth their fucking salt, unless they're a goddamn superstar, like a Turner, like a Petrovic, is going to be a top third goalkeeper in this league if they are that young and don't have literally any pro experience. And that goes for Freese and Barraza. And so I think if you go in with that expectation, you can see Barraza's performances and you're like, if this is someone you want to commit to long time, they're getting the time to learn things and whatever. And if you're going to do that, you have to explain and tell people, like, we are trying to build a goalkeeper for the future. They are not perfect yet. They will not be. We like their traits. Barraza's a fantastic shot stopper. And Freese has, you know, a very high floor in what he is as a goalkeeper. Both two young, extremely talented, but no experienced goalkeepers. The reason goalkeepers hit their prime when they're 30, 31, 32 is that they need game time and to build that muscle memory and to lose the nerves and the angst that comes with being a goalkeeper. Any goalkeeper. Sean Johnson, you know, an MLS, you know, he's going to be an all-timer in terms of goalkeeping with the volume that he has. And he became a very good goalkeeper for this team, a top five in the league. Not the best goalkeeper in the world, but a top five in the league at certain points because he had the volume because he was allowed to make the mistakes as an 18-year-old for Chicago. And I think, like, not understanding that context when talking about the goalkeepers is unfortunate for the goalkeepers. And I think that the front office has not still yet to name a starting goalkeeper a number one. And how many games are left? I don't understand that. But I will say this. The calls for Barraza's head were unnecessary and unseemly and did not successfully translate from his performances in the first half of the season. Given his last six or seven performances, you look at the numbers, you look at some of the goals he gave up, you look at his confidence, you can confidently say, we're going to give Matt Freese a try, because the wheels are looking wobbly for Barraza, and you can name 100 reasons why. But, you know, culture, whatever. But at the same time, Matt Freese deserved a start. And guess what? Matt Freese has been good and not perfect. And that's like because he's 25 with no experience. There are mistakes he's made that aren't good, but there's saves he makes and you go, okay, I see the potential for a top goalkeeper in this league. It's not perfect, but I like that finally they did make the right decision. Barraza was either plateauing or dropping off. I mean, he was dropping off. And this was having the cup game and then the midweek games, you know, to throw him in there is a good opportunity, and he took it and he did well. And I think they made the right decision at the right time. I just wish the whole situation was handled a lot differently.
Yeah, I understand. I agree with that too. But I think your key, but now I have to put the challenge back to you, Trey, because your key assertion here is that we can't just be flip-flopping and imagine that we're giving equal investment to both of these goalkeepers, that it's not just diluted because they're getting less play, but it's diluted because they're unable to build ahead of confidence or momentum or whatever, which begs the question, like, okay, it's, hey, congratulations, Cushing's out, you're the manager now. Who's your starting keeper?
As of now, it's Matt Freese. It's just you go off the
it's not just,
data you have.
Well, but is it? But because your language was, I think it's yes, give Matt Freese a try. But like, does that mean give Matt Freese a try and it's his to lose, or does it mean give Matt Freese a try and then two matches, like two bad matches, and it might be Barraza's again?
If I was the manager, if I was the,
you're no different than Cushing.
This is great. If I was the manager, I would not have two 25-year-olds that I'm trying to develop that have no pro experience. And if I did, and I took over today, I would say Matt Freese is our number one. He's going to have the job for the rest of the season, and we'll make decisions in the offseason. Like, that's what you say. You either let one of your goalkeepers know it wasn't good enough, but we still believe in you, and you can say, you know, Barraza was great the first half of the season. He was in a tough position. We strongly believe in his talent, whatever. But you have to commit to someone, and just like, so that at least there's a level of foundation, because when you're even questioning the goalkeeper position for so many times, it's this whole thing. We're talking about the balance again, and that's what it is. The balance between we want to bring in a lot of good people. We don't want to guarantee starting 11 spots to anyone because we want it to be as competitive as possible. Great. I love it. At the same time, now no one knows who is good, who is bad, who deserves it, who doesn't.
Yeah, it was a fun experiment. I don't know that it's working, you know?
Yeah.
Nothing's been borne out by it.
I don't know. All of this is coming, obviously, like, this is all armchair, as it usually is, because we're not in there watching practice and seeing the conversations that are being had. But when you have, like, certain players leaving that are clearly upset, like, things are not great. And so, like, I think certain levels of stability, and this is the thing you have to do if you have young players. It's like, if you have all young players, you have to have them all compete with each other and earn the spot. Well, okay, when one of them gets benched for someone else, they're going to be pissed because they're not an older player. They don't understand you can lose your job, and it's not the end of the world. And you can still help the team if you're not starting. Like, that's what I think has been lost in a lot of this season, is like the idea, like, okay, let's say, like, Talos Magno got benched, but, like, it was a rotating fucking door of who's starting and who's not. Like, Pellegrini was a black ink player in the starting 11, regardless of what anyone thinks about him, or should I say most people. And now he's lost his job, but clearly. And it's like, okay, so now what? But now Maxi's gone. Is he going to get the starting job again? Who knows? But I know if you're Andres Jason, who didn't even make the fucking plane to Cincinnati, but then gets a start midweek and scores, so he's earned a win. So he's earned another start. And now he was not necessarily lighting the world on fire against Vancouver. Is he terrified that he's going to lose his spot now too? Is he motivated? I don't know. And I think it applies to our goalkeeper. That's all I'm saying. And if you're questioning that one spot, you're going to start questioning a lot of other spots.
Yeah, I think that's... Well, I think those spots are already in question. But I also think that, like, it's a dubious honor to be the face of the franchise that is having its worst season since its inception. Since, you know, ever. Its worst season, its worst points per game season ever. Like, there has to be, everyone is trying to rally, everyone's trying to make playoffs, blah, 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 blah. They want to be the ones who can do it, they can be the ones who can do it. But it's also, like, I don't know. It's not the carrot and stick. It doesn't work if it's all stick. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if it's just like, I'm afraid of losing my job, and that's why I want to keep my job, that sort of runs out, I think. And I feel like we are watching that happen in Lifetime.
That's a great way to say it.
Let's end on an upper, my dude, my brother. We got 3 goals after about a month of not scoring. Which was a favorite for you? One of the Bakrars or Jason's little cheeky top corner?
No, Jason's was the best. It was the build up was like vintage 2021 NYCFC. The finish was mm-hmm. sublime. I didn't know Jason had that in his bag, and it's great to see.
No,
it's just, you know,
nearly breaking ankles out there. It was beautiful.
You have to give him credit for being a player. Like, he has a good attitude. Like, he has been benched for long stretches of the season. But when he comes in, like, he had a big goal against Philadelphia, and then he has this big goal, too. Like, they're big emotional uppers for the team. And being a homegrown player, I think it's important that he can help set the standard of patience and then showing up in his limited spots. And, like, that's good. However,
here's what I project onto. Oh, go ahead.
Oh no, I was going to just use
defeat
that
the purpose by doing caveats.
Yeah. Okay. So you say your thing, and then I'll caveat.
I was gonna say I feel like what I project onto Jason, you know, in terms of like my emotional investment in Jason is this is a dude who knows that he's not, you know, quote unquote, an elite player. He knows that he is not somebody who. Everyone is talking about how high his ceiling is, how much incredible potential he has. But he's someone who knows and has felt and repeats that if he just puts it all in every single match, he might one day wake up to discover that he's exceeded all expectations of his talent. And like goals like this prove it, you know? It's like you said, you didn't know he had it in him, but he did. And I don't know that he knows he had it in him, but what he does know is that if he doesn't go out there and try it and throw down with 110 fucking percent, yet that no one else is ever going to find out. And there's a nice safety to that too, right? Like that's not the weight of the world on your shoulders. That's just like, I can trust Andres to do his fucking job. And sometimes he does it well. And the more and more often he does it well, the more and more exceptional a player he's going to become.
Yeah. 100%. I don't know his mind, but I could see that happening too. You know, proof of concept. So my caveat was opportunity to talk about Bakrar, who scored the other 2 goals. A lot of fucking hand wringing about. Oh, we're still losing, but we signed a striker. Oh, who could have thought that was happening? It's all Nick Cushing's fault. Clearly, it doesn't matter if we had a striker or not. And I think that's obviously. Just saying we lost and we signed a striker, therefore it doesn't solve our problems. It's just completely ignoring the actual games that happen. Obviously, a player in his position, not only with the goals he's scoring, but the goals he's missing, he's creating more chances than, I mean, I expected. He's getting into all the right positions. You know, that speaks to him as a talent, but also that this team was missing a fucking 9 because the amount of space that's it's opened up for more chances, like how many shots have we had in all these games? How many more opportunities have we had? This team has looked more dangerous and generating more potential goals than they have at any point in the season because they have a striker on the team. Like it's clear proof that this team got a guy, they got a good guy, and they got him way too fucking late. And like I think it proves all those things. I think it says nothing about the manager necessarily, outside of the fact that like he could have banged the hard drum harder to sign a striker sooner. But outside of that, I love what he's bringing. His fucking sitters that he's missing. Like you can just imagine if the ball bounced the other way, and he got those in. The runs he's making on the Risa assist goal and on the Santi assist goal was fantastic. I mean, Mm-hmm. It's proof that he can be the player we need. I would love to play more to him and suit him more and try to build around him. Maybe be a little bit more of a counterattacking team because obviously he's shining in those moments. Or just maybe try to, I don't know, I understand why you want to play out wide so you can try to catch him running down the middle. But I think you could try to do more of that, but just focus more as him as a focal point than as some kind of a slow build to what he's bringing to the team. I'm actually really impressed with how he's played. Even if he does disappear in matches, like, again, this is a guy who has barely any minutes with this team. It will take time. Likewise for Julian, Risa, and all the others. Before we go to talking points, which is basically what this whole podcast has been, we had Santi and James return from injury. I think Santi played poorly in his first match back from injury, and I think that's to be expected of anyone that comes back from injury. He, at least the assist he had to Bakrar was a good sign that at least there's something still there. Right. He can still provide for the rest of the season if he puts his mind to it, if he feels fully fit. We have a two-week break. Now, with Maxi gone yet again, can he reestablish himself in some sort of role in this team? That's to see, but at least he showed a little bit more improvement coming back from the injury. The same cannot be said about James Sands. Talking about James Sands seems like a fucking third rail, you know, pun intended, but because everyone loves him so much, and he has been so good for this team for so long, he's like our OG homegrown. But his performances coming back from injury in the last most recent games have been, I mean, negative. Just net negative to the team, to the results. Just two stupid decisions for penalties. You can argue whether they were penalties or not, but he was not doing himself any favors putting himself in that position. And the coach not necessarily putting himself in a good position when we dropped a center back and like, okay, James Sands, you haven't played center back in a while. Now you are again. But I'm not saying it portends to any, like, he's a bust now. I'm just pointing out, like,
describing, right? Like, these penalties, like, they feel like mental mistakes. They feel like inexperienced mistakes. Do you feel like there's a sluggishness that's matched physically as well? Like, do you feel like his technical abilities have also suffered? Or is it just that he is not connecting with the game plan?
Yeah, I think it's time away. I think it's lack of being involved in a consistent level in both sides of the ball. Obviously, most obviously due to injury, but also team construction and stuff like that. Yeah, I'm not saying it's a negative. I'm just saying, like, one of the reasons results have not necessarily been going our way is that James Sands coming back from injury has not looked anywhere close to 100%. I mean, he's clearly still dealing with something. I don't know what it is, but I have to imagine because his talent is so high. Like, I just don't want him to become a player that is just so injured so often that he can never get fully integrated for a whole season. Just something I thought depressing. I'd point out. Just something I...
Very good, very good. I'm so glad that we ended on a downer so that we can go straight into talking points.
Talking points.
Which is, as you will not be surprised, exclusively downers. Here we go. You've already referred to it, but Maxi Morales is back out. We got him briefly, a shining star, a homecoming moment. And now an incredibly tragic and frustrating and painful ACL injury is going to require surgery. There's absolutely no way that we see any more Maxi this season, obviously. I'm also struck by the presser after the match where Nick Cushing said initial thoughts is that it's not super serious. That's fun. Did it feel as super serious to you as like everybody else seemed to intimate?
Yeah, Nick Cushing has never told the truth about injuries, almost ever. If it's a pointed question, and there's some gamesmanship there, of course, but something like this, I just don't understand. Like, just say, we'll see. I don't know why he had to. I don't know is okay to say. Because it was a lie. Because Maxi Morales, you know, generally when players get injured, really, like, I've been every single home game when the players are going to the locker room, I'm there watching them. And, which sounds creepy. And every time there's been a bad injury, the players will cross the field, you know, point A to point B, fastest way is a straight line, cross the field to go into the dugout, and immediately go up the stairs, and then they get put on a cart so they can go to medical to get a scan. Maxi's the first time in a while that I've seen a player, he got driven from cart from the other side of the field. He didn't even make the trip across the middle of the field. He couldn't. So I saw his cart go all the way around to medical. Then he came back from medical and went into the locker room. And he was helped off the cart by three people. He could not put any weight on it. Now, I want to apologize because I erroneously added, and I'm so stupid, and this is something I should know better. I was like, he wasn't putting any weight on it, so I assumed foot or ankle or even Achilles. But because usually if you have a ACL or some kind of knee injury, there's at least a level of weight you can put on. I mean, there obviously there's like pain involved and things like that. But what I was stupid, and I shouldn't have even guessed his injury anyway. I already deleted the tweet. You can't find it.
Well, it's work.
He, like, the fact that he came back from medical, needed help, and couldn't put weight on, and didn't have any ice, wraps, or braces, should have told me otherwise. I should have seen that and known this is his knee. But I was stupid, and I fucking fired that tweet off stupidly. But it was clearly the knee. Like, you don't learn. You can't tell something is a knee or ACL, MCL, any of those injuries without getting an MRI. You know, the medical that they go to for these scans is always, you know, an x-ray or something else, because you can't fit an MRI machine in a majority of stadiums. So that's why they didn't have an answer that night, but, you know, he got a scan, an MRI after. They wanted to see if they could rehab it a little bit, but they made the decision pretty quickly after realizing rehab was not going to happen, that he needed surgery. So, you know, that news was pretty much the next day when he was going to get the MRI that we found that out. But it's heartbreaking. I mean, I don't know what else to say. You know, the legend comes back one last ride, and he fucking blows out his ACL three games in after looking like he has changed the team, not a marginal amount. I mean, the team is much better when he's on the field.
No, this team, this season is determined to suck shit. It's bigger than any one man, you know. It'll devour you too. It's cursed. It's the house of Usher, and everyone's going down when it falls off the friggin' edge of the cliff or whatever. It's really quite depressing. Unless you're like certain players and you're able to get out while the getting is good. Trey, we have not had the chance to talk about the departure of Maxime Chanot. And before we get into the drama, because there is, you know, and it's fun to talk about, I think we need to spend just a second honoring this player who was a part of the squad that took home the cup, who has been captain and heir apparent to this team for a while, whose leadership in and out of the locker room has been obvious to anybody who's been spending any time around these players, who defined a style of defensive play and was arguably one of the best center backs in the run of in MLS, present or past. It Maxime Chanot's time with this club was exceptional, and it's a shame that it ended with such a whimper. What are the memories that you'll take with you from the Chanot era of NYCFC?
I think there was some revisionist history and recency bias when Alex Callens kind of had a fantastic end of 2021, beginning of 2022, that earned him a move elsewhere. that somehow Chanot was second fiddle defensively on this team the whole time they were together. And I think if you ask Alex Callens or anyone else with the team, like, Maxime Chanot was the anchor defensively of this team. This team has been one of the best defensive teams in the league since 2016, since his arrival. He helped usher, he helped build this connection with Alex Callens that allowed Callens to meet his potential. Just them hearing them talk about playing with each other was beautiful. It was exactly what you want from center backs. They both would say, like, we don't talk to each other, which is a panicky thing to hear unless you have the best center back duo in the league, in which it's an amazing thing. Like, they just knew how each other played so well that they could play so well together. And I think if Alex Callens is remembered as one of the best center backs in this team and at his best, one of the best center backs in this league, I think Chanot probably, even though he's not necessarily as dynamic or versatile as a player, is one of the most sound defensive players this league has had in the last 10 years. The duo that they built was clearly number two the last 2 years they were together, but number one in that season. You talk about 2019, like, the best defensive pairing, bar none. Them with Sean Johnson built a triumvirate that no one ever wanted to face. I think if you look at how other fans talk about this team, we lost the two players that the other teams are scared of, and that's Maxi Morales and Maxime Chanot. Anytime I'm talking with fans of other teams or other podcasts, or I'm looking at game threads or whatever, it's always like, oh, fucking Maxime Chanot, of course. Anytime he made a great tackle, oh, we fucking can't get past that guy. It's every time. He was someone you didn't want to face because he was intense. He was a gamer. He knew situationally, like, that's the joke. Last 10 minutes, when is Chanot's head injury coming? Guess what? He knew that, and it was smart. It worked every fucking time. He shaved 2 minutes off the end of every game we were winning anytime we were. Mm-hmm. He was clearly a leader for this team. He was the connective string from the first era of this team to now. And I think it says a lot that he decided to take a pay cut and stay. And at the beginning of the season, no matter who the fuck was paired next to him, this defense overperformed drastically the first half of the season. And it all comes down to him and what he brought to this team. Of course, I'll say it every time he's brought up, he was the best player on the field in the 2021 MLS Cup final, at least for the first 90 minutes. He was fouled on that play. His boy told him that he fouled him on that play, and I hope that remains still in the annals of MLS history, that we don't forget that Portland, we got a great game from that moment, but it should not have happened in the first place. And he's a legend, and he deserves a statue, but unfortunately, as has had sometimes for this team, for better or for worse, bridges were burned. And it sucks to see. It sucks to see a hero of this team leave the way they did. I'm the second Chanot left and all this stuff started coming up, it instantly made me reanalyze what was going on with Sean Johnson. I don't know what happened. I'm still trying to find out. But all those motherfuckers keep stonewalling me, but I will find out. But even them not wanting to talk about it is perhaps a message in itself. It just sucks that it happened the way it did. And I'm glad, you know, I'm happy you had the same thought I did, where we had to give him his 5 minutes of, you know, a top five center back in this league for 7 years. I mean, that is, unfortunately, they don't make medals for that, but they should, because he deserved it.
So then what do you take? All right, now let's dissect the tea. Is it just as simple as we're sniping at Cushing because Cushing put Chanot in a feeling? Cushing made Chanot feel that the team wasn't going in the right direction, or that the energy was toxic, or that Chanot himself wasn't being valued? Was it that Chanot felt himself being phased out in this vision toward the future, and was not going to sit around and, like, watch it happen and put up with it?
That second one's right on the money. But also, I was about to say, I need to be careful how I talk about these things, whatever, but you kind of nailed it on that second one. But
oh, great. So, but well, I just guessed, so, just to, you know, no one broke anything. Just to, no one broke anybody's trust at
just
all.
Just to go a little bit deeper, you know, because I know everyone wants to know, like, what happened. And there are things we know. There are things I know that I can't share out of, you know, whatever, trust. You know, someone found something out. They told me, but told me not to tell people because they might want
to
report it.
You are constantly on this podcast talking like you are married to someone who works on this
team.
I'm
going
to
give
some information. Like, in pillow talk, you've been told, you know, like, post-oral, you get a mouthful of something else, which is hot goss that you refuse to share with your friends and buddies at Blue Balls.
Okay, I'm just prefacing because I just want to say I don't know the entire story, and no one does. And part of that is because the team smartly will not say what happened. So their side of the story is gone. But you can imagine it because the truth, as always, lies somewhere in the middle. So Chanot leaves, right? He doesn't start that game before Cincinnati. Everyone's like, what the fuck's going on? Then he doesn't make the plane. Everyone's like, what the fuck's going on? Next day, there's rumors he's going to Ajaccio, and which, yes, I'm saying the Italian version of that team, you motherfuckers. And then the press release comes, right? And he does the interview video, and he's like, oh, I want to thank everyone, David Lee and all the coaches I've worked with, and I just wanted to play in front of my family. And, like, that's the party line, obviously. And everyone read that, and it's like, oh, he just wanted to leave. Well, I'm not going to say everyone, because I'm actually, the cynicism from the fan base really paid off in this situation, because the whole press release shit, the people, everyone that saw right through it was 100% right, because Chanot obviously came out right an hour after the press release went out. You know, the main reason giving, he wanted to play close to his family, but he tweets out just a picture of him holding his USSF B license. And it's like, well, that could mean a few things. And then after Nick Cushing's press conference, which, by the way, I think everyone should go and listen to that press conference after the win against Montreal, because I think it's like a good press conference in terms of the entertainment you get from it. Like, not that it's supposed to be an entertaining thing, but I think it runs the gamut. You have a coach clearly under pressure who just got a big win, and like the emotions kind of throughout it are cool. I think Nick Cushing is a very good talker, and I kind of love some of the big paragraphs and speeches he gave in that press conference, but he was saying all the right things about Maxime Chanot, and I think he wanted to say, we lost Maxime Chanot at a very difficult time, and what came out of his mouth was, Maxime Chanot left us at a very difficult time, and that is the wrong thing to say to a player that's been pissed off, because Maxime Chanot tweets from his private account yet again, difficult situation made by ? Thinking emoji. Which, yeah, so he was not happy with that turn of phrase there. And so the situation as I know it, as I can say it, you fucking bitch, is clearly he was just, like, not happy with the direction the team was going, with the emotional viability of the locker room and everything. I think so he was upset, clearly. Like, he was not happy with how the team was using him, not only on the field, but off the field. And I think that's what the little picture of the coaching license was. You know, I read it at first as, oh, he's going to come back to coach. What a nice farewell. I was not cynical enough. I think it was extremely likely. In fact, I'm positive. It was, hey, I know what I'm talking about. And
yeah, yeah. Learn to coach, dipshit.
Yeah, to some extent. And more so, like, I believe he was probably put in his place a few times. Like, no, we're the coaches, you're the players, trust us, we know what we're doing, whatever. And he was like, no, I do know what I'm doing, and this is not right. And it just created enough friction over time. And you add in him getting benched, and the fact that he was going to be phased out, and you know, if I would say that the front office's point of view, and I don't know, again, this is the part of the story we don't know, they probably saw a player who was increasingly getting frustrated and was kind of throwing wrenches into things and being a little too assertive or being too much of a coach, and it was ruining that kind of thing, and he just was never going to sit back and take it, which was what makes him a great defender, but maybe not the best coworker. And he's a passionate guy. And I don't think this is to say that he's wrong in any extent necessarily at how he behaved, but subtweets after the fact are not necessarily the most professional way to get your point across. But at the same time, you have to understand his frustration. This is the most frustrating year of soccer I've had as a fan of a team, perhaps ever, of any team I've been a fan of. And I will say that I don't think this was – I keep saying don't think. These are things I know. This was not a Chanel versus Cushing situation. I know everyone wants to paint it that way, and I know it can seem that way. This was – I think people overestimate and have all year Nick Cushing's role in the whole ecosystem. Yes, he's the head coach. He picks the team. He makes the tactics. But he's also a CFG guy, and the whole – outfit, even when Ronnie Dyla was here, was like, the front office is going to make a lot of decisions. The performance analysis are going to make a lot of decisions. And the head coach has to find a way to weave themselves into this whole thing. Ronnie Dyla was so, like, hands-off and a great man motivator that he was okay leaving some of those things to someone else and dealing with everything else. I think that Chanel had a problem with the blob that was Nick Cushing. And I don't think he had a problem with the other coaches necessarily. Maybe that the fact that they're also part of the blob, and the blob that is everything else. And when you're the youngest, the fucking oldest guy by a mile on this team, it can be hard when you lose all these games. And the young players, as I've reported from the locker room many times, don't seem to take it hard enough. Mm-hmm. That can get frustrating as a player, and I think that's the situation start to finish that I know. That's literally all the information I know, by the way. I don't know. That's all I got.
Yeah, there's some disjoint. Well, we appreciate you lending your clarity and your eagle eye to it, Trey. We have only so much time, and so I need two quick hot takes. One on Gabraham Siegelman's departure to the Holy Land. Gabe Siegel is headed, of course, to Israel. This is probably a player that we've devoted an undue amount of time to on this podcast, but only because of the weirdness of this season, right? There was a brief and shining moment where we were like, well, maybe he'll save our ass. Maybe he'll fix everything. And now it's a little melancholy to see him leave, in a way that's sort of unusual for a player who comes and goes from NYCFC fan consciousness in less than a season. How are you feeling about it?
Well, I think it's great that we spoke it into existence. I want to believe that his agents listened to our podcast and thought it would be really funny if they sent him to an Israeli team. I do think it's a fantastic move for him. He's going to a league where he'll try to get playing time on a good team in a league that gets Champions League spots and will play some tough games, and it's going to be great for his experience. And I wish him all the best.
Now, tell me this, Trey. Is this one of the racist ones?
I actually don't know. Maybe. I mean, okay. Don't you're trying to trick me into saying something that will be racist. So I'm not going to speak on that. But I think that's another. I don't think there was anything. This was not a Chanel situation. I don't think there was any bad blood necessarily. I think Gabe saw the writing on the wall and was like, I just want a place where I can win playing time. Bakar's not losing that spot. And
yeah, he had his chance and it's gone. Or rather, it came and went. And God bless him. He put his all into it. Maybe he'll find it somewhere else.
When we talk about the recency bias that the rose-colored glasses we get a lot of the time, I think Gabe Siegel scored big goals in big moments. And that's amazing. And you have to love a player like that. But that doesn't mean you have to love how they play. And I think there was plenty of opportunities given to Gabe at the beginning of the season to show what kind of player he could be for this team. And that it just wasn't. And it's understandable. He's a new, young, extremely young player being thrown into a brand new team that's in fucking disarray. He did not perform to a standard that I think people think he is based on him scoring big goals in big moments. Just like anytime he wasn't scoring a goal, it was not – he wasn't making the team better necessarily. I don't know how to say this without sounding mean. So
yeah, he wasn't as good as we needed him to be. Yeah. What do you want? You know what I mean?
Sure.
But like we are, but it was it. But in there were flashes of that possibility, and that means that like there may he may still have like a significant career ahead of him. We hope he does, as we do with all, you know, alumni of New York City FC. Trey, we have less than zero time left, so I want to pivot, and I'm going to force you to wait to talk about, Tavon Gray and Jamaica, but. I feel like our podcast is slowly becoming a bit where we say we'll talk about Messi next time, but we will talk about Messi next time. In the meantime, can you give us any sense of whether you feel like we have a chance in hell against or to take a point or 3 points even off of the Hudson River rivalry, the derby we're playing this Saturday? Red Bulls, of course, not sitting in a better position than we are. And with fewer matches played, so it's a really important one, but especially, you know, with all of the crises that we have just outlined, is there any chance that they're showing up in worse shape than we are this weekend?
There is a chance. We have a chance. I believe so, because I have no idea what the fuck's gonna happen, because what we have is two fucking Beyblades of underwhelming teams and underperforming teams fucking going at it. And who knows what the fuck's going to happen. I truly think that's what these two teams are walking into. Two teams extremely underperforming their advanced metrics. Just like so much so that you can't even say it's bad luck. It's just teams just not delivering on the performances that they've built. And you have to point to something ethereal like bad culture or bad emotions or whatever. Not being put in good positions. And I think, you know, we played them recently. We played them in the cup. And I think we played them in the first 20 minutes of that match exactly how we had to. It's not good and it's not pretty. And we don't look beautiful doing it. But we held the ball as much as we could. We made as little mistakes as possible. We were moving the ball away from our back line so that we could have enough breathing space not to make a mistake. And then we made a mistake. And the second we did, I knew we were going to lose that match. Like, there was no chance. And it just comes down to that. It's like, who's going to break first? Can NYCFC hold the ball long enough and not make a mistake to score once they relieve the press just a little bit? Or are they going to capitalize on a mistake we make and they're just fucking waiting for it? And it's one or the other is going to happen. But NYCFC, unfortunately, need to play fucking ugly and try to keep as much possession as possible and waste as much time as possible and wait out the Red Bulls for them to have a chance. And that's all it is. The be all and end all is just, you know, play the same exact thing we did against them last match and just don't make a mistake. You're not going to beat them any other way. No one has in fucking 20 years.
Uh-huh. Grind it to a halt. It reminds me of the gif of where Bart is closing his eyes and kicking, and Lisa is closing her eyes and swinging her fists, you know? And just they're slowly inching towards each other. That may be a lot of what we see for a significant period of this match, and then a couple moments where the Beyblades hit. So, yeah, no, I'm excited in my own way. What's your scoreline?
A draw. The most depressing thing ever would be a draw, either 0-0 or 1-1. I mean, because then,
yeah.
I guess mathematically we might still be able to make the playoffs, but it will certainly feel dead. And if we win, at
yes.
least
and we'll
still
know
some
we
hope.
Could have.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
We'll have felt the closeness of it and also the infinite distance.
So yeah, it's a draw.
Trey, where do you tweet at?
Wait, what's your prediction?
Oh, I'll take I'll throw the optimism on. I'm going to say a 2-0 win. I'm going to say it breaks our way, and I'm going to say it does not change the season, and that we are done, folks.
Yeah, watch.
I do not see it.
Watch Burke Risa this match. Going to be very key.
Trey, where do you tweet at?
Trey Fillmore, what about you?
Jake Beckhard, when we both tweet at Blue Balls Pod. Tip jar is in the link. So is the merch store. No one's bought anything for months. Get on there. It's winter. We'll release some new winter shit. I'll go on there and make it all up. But if you don't, we'll still love you, and we can't wait to see you next week on the other side of the Derby. Thanks so much for listening. As always, see you then.
Bye. Goodbye.